Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Romney versus three anti-Romneys. Good morning, everyone. We will begin today with three excerpts from last night's Republican presidential debate, including the one that is making the most news this morning, Newt Gingrich appearing to be a little soft by Republican primary standards on illegal immigration. The idea here is three exchanges with a presumed front runner. I know he's not the front runner in the polls, but everybody thinks, well, Romney's going to win the nomination unless somebody stops him. So kind of the presumed front runner, Romney with Newt, Rick Perry, and John Huntsman. And let's begin with the Gingrich clip on immigration and Romney's response. The blowback came over Gingrich saying, we aren't going to send 11, 12 million people here illegally back to their countries. Here's just a little bit of the Gingrich part and a little bit of the Romney part.
I do not believe that the people of the United States are going to take people who've been here a quarter century, who have children and grandchildren, who are members of the community, who may have done something 25 years ago, separate them from their families, and expel them. I do believe if you've been here recently and you have no ties to the U.S., we should deport you. I do believe we should control the border. I do believe we should have very severe penalties for employers. But I'd urge all of you to look at the Kriebel Foundation plan. I don't see how the party that says it's the party of the family is going to adopt an immigration policy which destroys families that have been here a quarter century. And I'm prepared to take the heat for saying, let's be humane in enforcing the law.
Amnesty is a magnet. When we have had in the past programs that have said that the people who've come here illegally are going to get to stay illegally for the rest of their life, that's going to only encourage more people to come here illegally. The right course for our immigration system is to say we welcome people who want to come here legally. We're going to have a system that makes that easier and more transparent, but to make sure we're able to bring in the best and brightest. And by the way, I agree with the speaker in terms of I'd staple a green card to the diploma of anybody who's got a degree of math, science, a master's degree, PhD. We want those brains in our country. But in order to bring people in legally, we've got to stop illegal immigration.
Gingrich and Romney from last night's foreign policy national security debate on CNN. And with me first on this, the Takeaways Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd was doing, as some of you know, because you were doing it too, the live chat with me during the debate on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Hi, Todd. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hi. Happy Thanksgiving, Brian. Good to talk to you.
So why did Gingrich bring this up? Did he stumble into it? Was it calculated? Why utter an encouraging word to people out of status in a Republican debate?
A little bit puzzling because look who got around Newt Gingrich's right. Mitt Romney, pretty amazing in a primary. You would expect Gingrich, who's been very, very careful to take some of the most conservative, even in some cases right-wing positions and rhetoric, you would expect him to keep that tack. Was it a stumble? Who knows? It's probably a closely held position that Newt Gingrich believes in. He expounded on it. He talked about it twice. He repeated his position in a post-debate interview with a CNN reporter on the stage there. So he's sticking to his guns. He didn't walk it back, said he's willing to take the heat for it, and he must be willing to do it. Maybe Newt Gingrich now, that he's close to the top of the heap, and we'll see how long he stays there, is starting to take a cue from Romney. You know, Brian, it's been amazing to watch Mitt Romney throughout almost this entire campaign. Yes, he's taking very conservative positions, but you really see the way this guy debates. He is running a general election campaign. In a lot of the cases where other candidates are sniping at each other or trying as hard as they can to really use the dog whistles and the rallying cries of the right, abolish the Fed, audit the Fed, TARP was wrong, you know, we have to stay in Afghanistan for much longer, all of these things. Mitt Romney, rather, has taken pains to take the general election moderate swing voter position, won't talk about abolishing the Fed, talks about TARP in a much more nuanced way than other candidates do. Now, on immigration, he has taken, even though he's taken a pretty hard right stance, has talked about the business case, the corporate case for strong, open, legal immigration. And you think, okay, the guys in the Republican primary. Immigration's a very, very contentious issue and a big deal on the right, so he has to take a conservative position, but he's running in the general. So he's right. got this close-the-border position and a pro-business, sort of pro-corporate, we need the labor and let's have good legal immigration. It's, and then all of a sudden, Newt got around to his right, and you think, oh boy, that's – that. Or, sorry, Newt got to his left, I should say, towards the middle, saying, let's be compassionate. It was quite amazing.
It is quite amazing, and you're right. Romney, to my eye, also is running – a Rose Garden strategy. He's as if the incumbent, as if the front runner, even though he never quite maintains front runner status in these Republican polls. Kaine had it for a while. Now Gingrich has got it. But Romney sees himself as running as the presumed nominee. But on Gingrich, to me, if you watch the whole debate, as you did and I did, Newt's strategy was to be the angrier, more conservative alternative to Romney, who is Mr. Smooth, Mr. Too Smooth for many in the GOP. But the news story coming out of the debate, for anyone who didn't watch, is this idea of Gingrich going soft on illegal immigration. So I don't know. I think he lost control of the narrative.
Well, the reason why a lot of Republican commentators and journalists are so taken aback by what Newt did is that there's precedent for this. Rick Perry, who was hailed as the next big thing. Of course, they all were when they started to challenge Romney. But when Rick Perry was a little bit of will he, won't he, and they were building up the anticipation of his campaign, the one thing that really hobbled him straight out of the gates was this remark that he had made early on to say that people – that they had a policy in Texas to – state-funded education even for the children of illegal immigrants. Rick Perry supported it, and Rick Perry stood by it. Fine, that's his policy position. He made a remark saying that people who think that children here through no fault of their own shouldn't be educated are heartless. And it took about 36 hours before Rick Perry was backpedaling and straight up apologizing for that remark, for calling people on the right heartless for not wanting to educate children. There's a precedent for this, and it's Rick Perry. And now people are starting to wonder, did Newt Gingrich step in the same puddle that Rick Perry did before he even got his campaign off the ground? We will see. But Newt Gingrich, go ahead.
But, well, by the way, I know you wanted us to replay this moment from the very beginning where they were introducing themselves, where Willard introduces himself this way.
I'm Mitt Romney, and yes, Wolf, that's also my first name.
Well, fact check.
Because right? Wolf Blitzer had started by saying, I'm Wolf Blitzer, and yes, that's my real name. And he said, I'm Mitt Romney, and that's really my real name. But, okay, fact check.
Fact check, you just said it. Mitt Romney's first name is Willard. It's not Mitt. Mitt is his nickname. It's his middle nickname. You know, he is Willard Mitt Romney. And if he ever does get into the Oval Office or onto Mount Rushmore, he'll be, I guess, he'll be Willard Romney or W. Mitt Romney. But his first name's Willard.
Is Mitt his middle name?
I think, let me check that. I don't know if it's his nickname. I think Mitt is his middle name. Yeah.
I don't know. These are very Republican names, Mitt and Newt. I don't think Democrats get names like Mitt and Newt. I don't know why, but I just don't think they do. We won't replay the moment where Herman Kaine called him
Blitz
instead of Wolf a couple of times. I said, I'm sorry.
Twitter loved that one.
I know. That was just a little slip of the tongue. But I'm sorry, Blitz. I meant to call you Wolf or whatever it was. So, all right.
Mitt is his middle name. I checked it. Willard Mitt Romney.
Okay.
Yep.
Romney versus not Romney number two. Texas Governor Rick Perry tried to muscle his way back into the top tier by proposing new muscle towards Syria. Rick Perry and Mitt's response in about a minute.
When you put the no-fly zone above Syria, it obviously gives those dissidents and gives the military the opportunity to maybe disband that want to get out of the situation that they're in Syria as well. So I think if we're serious about Iran, and that's what we're really talking about here, we're talking about Syria is a partner with Iran in exporting terrorism all across that part of the world and around the globe. So if we're serious about Iran, then we have to be serious about Syria as well. So I think a no-fly zone is an option, of one of a multitude of options that we should be using.
He's getting pressured now from both Turkey as well as Saudi Arabia. They're coming and putting pressure on him. The Arab League is putting pressure on him. That's the right way to go. And by the way, they have 5,000 tanks in Syria. A no-fly zone wouldn't be the right military action. Maybe a no-drive zone. I mean, this is a nation. This is a nation which is not bombing its people at this point, and the right course is not military.
We're ready to wrap it up.
About a minute of Perry and Romney last night on Syria, no-fly zone versus no-drive zone, which got a laugh from the audience. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, with us. And also joining us now, Rehan Salam from the News Corp app, The Daily, and from National Review's domestic policy blog, The Agenda. Happy Thanksgiving, Rehan.
Thank you very much, sir.
And did you understand what Perry was calling for there? It seemed almost to be a no-fly zone over Syria as a hedge against Iran.
Well, we've seen no-fly zones before. For example, over Iraq after the Gulf War, we had a no-fly zone there for a very long period of time.
For years after the first Gulf War in the 90s.
Absolutely. And one of the complicating factors here is that a no-fly zone isn't really something you do that's short of war. Rather, it is a kind of warfare that is very expensive and difficult to maintain. The first step in any no-fly zone is to destroy the air defenses of the target country. And that's a big undertaking. And it's not clear that Governor Perry is endorsing a full-scale war on Syria, but of course that's what it would entail. And a no-drive zone would entail that even more so.
Because of the tanks, as Romney pointed out. So, Todd, what do you think Perry was getting at there? Did he call for a no-fly zone over Libya, which is exactly what the U.S. and NATO, over Syria, just what the U.S. and NATO had imposed over Libya, which turned into, you know, war right on behalf of the rebels.
If you wanted to give Rick Perry a little help on the answer, and it sounded like maybe he could have used a little help just being more specific, you might say exactly that, Brian, that maybe he wanted to replicate the NATO model when there was uprising and revolution in Libya to try to help the revolution along. Maybe we can replicate that in Syria, even though they are far different places. On the other hand, what Rick Perry wound up doing, it seems, especially from that cut that you played, is doing Mitt Romney a big favor. Rick Perry did not explain his position very well. He wasn't extremely clear as to why he wanted to do it and what the philosophy or the doctrine behind it would be. And it gave Mitt Romney that great opportunity to further define Mitt Romney as well-prepared, well-read, briefed up. I understand Syria, don't you? It's not really about Rick Perry. It's now Mitt Romney's time to shine by sounding like he's been thinking about this for ages.
And again,
and his answer made a lot of sense.
And again, Rehan, this is at odds, the Perry position, with the usual Republican position. Isn't it that U.S. adventurism on behalf of democracy is not what they're interested in unless there's immediate U.S. national security interest at stake, Iraq notwithstanding? But Republicans mostly opposed Obama on Libya.
This has been an interesting post-Bush turn in Republican foreign policy. One of the big critiques of the Libya intervention has indeed been this question of whether or not we have an exit strategy, whether or not it's sensible to get involved. And I think that this conversation about a no-fly zone, no-drive zone reflects that.
Do you think Romney came prepared for this, Todd? Because he got off that good zinger about them having tanks, and so what we really need is a no-drive zone. It sounded like it was a line he had ready to go, but he probably did not walk into that debate hall last night thinking that Rick Perry was going to propose, or maybe he did because Perry had first floated it earlier in the day. So maybe he was ready for the no-fly zone Rick Perry moment.
One thing that Mitt Romney has been able to do in almost all of these debates, despite just one or two small stumbles, is present himself as extremely well-prepared, appearing presidential, running that Rose Garden strategy, already running in the general, tends to not pay attention to his rivals, sort of brushes him off. He sees him in the rearview mirror. The attacks that Mitt Romney really has to deal with that count are coming from the DNC and from the White House these days. I'll tell you that. It's the White House that's going after Mitt Romney. They think that he's the man. It gave him yet again an opportunity to show just how prepared he is. And one of the raps on Mitt Romney that you hear from other Republican campaigns when they send out emails is, yeah, he sounds great. He's been running for president for 6 years.
Right.
Of course he sounds pretty good.
Somebody said that on stage last night, or Gingrich said it maybe on CNN afterwards.
Yeah.
All right. Romney versus not Romney, number three. This time it's former Utah Governor John Huntsman advocating a faster drawdown in Afghanistan.
I said we should draw down from 100,000. We don't need 100,000 troops. We don't need 100,000 troops. Many of whom can't even cross the wire. We need a presence on the ground that is more akin to 10 or 15,000. That will serve our interests in terms of intelligence gathering and special forces response capability. And we need to prepare for a world, not just in South Asia, but indeed in every corner of the world, in which counterterrorism is going to be in front of us for as far as the eye can see into the 21st century.
And the commanders on the ground feel that we should bring down our surge troops by December of 2012 and bring down all of our troops, other than perhaps 10,000 or so, by the end of 2014. The decision to pull our troops out before that, they believe, would put at risk the extraordinary investment of treasure and blood which has been sacrificed by the American military.
Just about the generals on the ground. And listen, I think it's important for the American people to know we have achieved some very important objectives in raising standards in Afghanistan and helping to build civil society. But at the end of the day, the President of the United States is Commander-in-Chief. Commander-in-Chief. Of course you're going to listen to the generals. But I also remember when people listened to the generals in 1967, and we heard a certain course of action in Southeast Asia didn't serve our interests very well.
About a minute and a quarter of Huntsman and Romney at the national security debate hosted by CNN last night. Among the Republican presidential hopefuls were with Raihan Salam from The Daily and National Review and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Raihan, explain that exchange from both candidates' point of view.
So that was incredibly fascinating for a number of complicated historical reasons, one of which is that Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, was a presidential contender, a very serious one, in the late 1960s. And his presidential ambitions basically ended when he went on a local television program in Detroit and said the reason why his position on Vietnam had changed, he went from being relatively hawkish to being relatively dovish, is that he had been brainwashed by generals, diplomats, and other U.S. government officials while in South Vietnam. Now, he had made that term, he had used the term colloquially, but then it basically discredited him completely. So there was some interesting resonance when Huntsman said, hey, wait a second, you can't just listen to the generals, you're the commander-in-chief, whereas Mitt Romney was hewing to this more cautious position. I also think, however, that Romney basically won that exchange. Look, there's a tremendous amount of resentment between these two guys. Their families have known each other for a long time, yet Huntsman has clashed with Romney most poignantly when he endorsed John McCain as a Mormon governor of Utah in 2008 rather than Romney. So this is – if Huntsman stays in this race, this is going to get uglier and uglier.
Todd, as I mentioned several times in the chat last night, in our online chat during the debate – I think Huntsman is having trouble becoming the not Romney because he's too much like Romney, running as the sensible grown-up rather than the populist firebrand. How much do you see that? And yet his strategy is to beat Romney at his own game by winning a divided electorate in New Hampshire.
I have been fascinated watching John Huntsman from the very start sort of recognize what he calls, and I'm paraphrasing, the strain of crazy or the strain of Yahooism in some of the ranks of the Republican base electorate. Those are my words, not his, but he's alluded to them. And really going for the sensible middle on issues like climate change and sort of using data from science and really kind of trying to out-moderate Mitt Romney. Now, it hasn't worked, because let's all look at where, as good a debater as he is, John Huntsman languishes in low single digits in the polls. But wasn't that fascinating last night? And I'll bet you Raihan recognizes this too. He knows far more about this than I. Hearing that cut from last night on Afghanistan, a redux of the old debate of counterinsurgency versus counterterrorism. What should be our strategy post 9/11? How do we combat terrorism around the world? This is the old fight of Joe Biden, Colin Powell versus the neocons. Should we be fighting counterinsurgency strategy in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, or should we be fighting counterterror with just a few boots on the ground, light special forces going going after individual terrorists without tanks and howitzers and airplanes and stuff going on. It's a redux of the debate we've been having for 8 or 10 years between two candidates on the stage. I found it, by the way, even though there was a bit of shouting, incredibly substantive and enlightening and amazing that this fight still goes on. We still haven't settled it 2 wars later.
All right. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Raihan Salam will stay with us and take a closer look after the break at the intellectual basis for Gingrich's position, which got him into some conservative trouble last night, on illegal immigration. It's something called the Kriebel Foundation Plan, which he cited by name in the debate. We'll play that part of the clip, and we'll explain the Kriebel Foundation Plan on immigration in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, Monday after the Thanksgiving break, we will start that week with Paul Krugman from the New York Times talking about what comes after the sequestration budget, what comes after the deficit super committee failed. Right now, we'll take a closer look at the intellectual grounding behind the statement that got Newt Gingrich into some trouble from his right at the debate last night that we're not going to deport 12 million illegal aliens. He referenced something called the Kriebel Foundation Plan. Here is a little context from that debate around that reference, Newt Gingrich.
You need something like a World War II Selective Service Board that frankly reviews the people who are here. If you're here, if you've come here recently, you have no ties to this country, you ought to go home, period. If you've been here 25 years and you got 3 kids and 2 grandkids, you've been paying taxes and obeying the law, you belong to a local church, I don't think we're going to separate you from your family, uproot you forcefully, and kick you out. The Kriebel Foundation has a very good red card program that says you get to be legal, but you don't get a path to citizenship. And so there's a way to ultimately end up with a country where there's no more illegality, but you haven't automatically given amnesty to anyone.
Newt Gingrich didn't exactly sound like LaRazza there. Still with us is Raihan Salam, who writes for The Daily, Rupert Murdoch's iPad app newspaper, and for The Agenda, which is National Review's domestic policy blog. So, Raihan, what is the Kriebel Foundation, first of all, and who is Helen Kriebel?
Well, it's a really fascinating little think tank run by the Kriebel family, the third generation of which Helen Kriebel is the one who drafted this red card solution. And basically, it takes the view that the immigration problem has been badly misunderstood, that there are immigrants who want to enter a path of citizenship and become lawful permanent residents, and there's another group of immigrants who actually, in an ideal world, would come to work in the United States for a discrete period of time and then go back home. And the red card concept is to separate those two groups, to give lots of people from poorer countries in the world the opportunity to access the U.S. labor market, but then don't create this enforcement regime that leads them to fear going back and forth across the border.
And it's known as a red card plan because it's got a different endpoint than a green card?
That's exactly right. What it does is it creates this card, which has biometric security features and what have you, that immigrants could swipe when they enter the border, when they arrive, via airplane, et cetera. And then that would give the U.S. federal government the opportunity to know when these folks are in the country or not. This, by the way, is an idea that some libertarians might find creepy. And the idea is that, these people could stay as long as they have an employer, as long as it's guaranteed that they are employed, so that, the anxiety it addresses is that you have this population of people who are floating. We don't know very much about them. They could be criminals, et cetera. So it addresses some of those anxieties that are very pervasive among immigration critics.
Do you think that there really are a lot of people in that red card category? That is, of the 12 million illegal immigrants right now, or however many there really are, and the overwhelming majority of them are from Mexico, do you think there really is a large number that would be happy with a red card solution, which would mean they would have to go back to Mexico after a certain period of time?
Well, it's a complicated answer to that question because basically it's a dynamic system. And as the immigration enforcement regime in the United States has become tougher, then you have fewer people who are circular migrants because it's more dangerous for them to be circular migrants. So the idea here is that the red card solution would meet the needs of American employers because you could could, for example, have a situation in which you have other constituencies, not just folks who are here in the country right now, but you're attracting other workers, knowing that they're not going to become a burden on the social services system, which, again, is one of those anxieties of immigration critics.
How did that get reinterpreted as an amnesty plan by Michelle Bachmann and others after the debate?
Well, because Newt Gingrich introduced this idea of a selective service board, and this is an approach that, for example, Switzerland takes. The idea is that you have communities in a decentralized fashion making judgments regarding the level of attachment of immigrants to the United States. So the idea here of many immigration critics, folks who want to reduce the amount of immigration in the United States, like the Center for Immigration Studies, is that you need to follow a strategy of attrition. That is, through more aggressive enforcement, people who are least attached to the country are going to be the first to leave. And then you have these other people, like those that Newt Gingrich mentioned, who've been here for a long period of time, who have native-born children and grandchildren, who are more likely to stay and who don't raise a lot of those anxieties that the kind of conventional immigration critique raises.
You blogged about the Kriebel Foundation plan on the agenda this morning, your blog on National Review Online, as trying to reconcile competing interests. What competing interests does it try to reconcile?
Well, one of the competing interests is the concern of employers. For example, in the state of Alabama, we've had aggressive enforcement efforts that have led to a situation in which many employers no longer have access to the same amount of immigrant labor as they had before. But despite very high domestic unemployment, these are jobs that it's still very hard for them to fill with domestic workers. So that's one competing interest, the interest of employers in finding workers who are willing to take on these labor-intensive jobs. Another interest, however, is from immigration critics who have concerns, some of which are more reasonable than others, regarding immigrant criminality and what have you. I should mention that immigrants don't commit crimes at a level any higher than native-born folks. But regardless, there is an anxiety over this, terrorism, and also rapid cultural change.
How do immigration advocacy groups feel about the Kriebel plan? Are they interested in it at all?
Well, my impression is that the Kriebel plan is really something that has come out of left field. It's a kind of quirky idea that hasn't been thoroughly debated in traditional immigration circles. But ideas like it have been around for a long time, particularly this idea of a temporary guest worker program. And that idea raises a lot of anxieties, not just from traditional immigration advocacy groups, but from people who feel as though creating this separate track of people who are not on a citizenship track actually has all kinds of implications for our democracy, and that, you know, you're creating what the Greeks would have called a helot class of people who are just here as workers, who are here on the sufferance of their employers, which potentially gives their employers a lot of power over them. Talk to anyone who has an H-1B visa, which is tied to your employer, and you see that there can be a lot of anxiety around that as well.
And if we're going to have Newt Gingrich to kick around for a while, as they say, then we're going to hear about ideas with references to where they came from that are below the surface as far as most people are concerned, like the Kriebel Foundation plan actually being mentioned in the debate. Another one that he brought up last night that you've also blogged about is called Lean Six Sigma. And I'm going to play the Lean Six Sigma moment. Here it is.
If we were serious, we would open up enough oil fields in the next year that the price of oil worldwide would collapse. Now, that's what we'd do if we were a serious country. If we were serious, one last thing. If we were serious, we would apply Strong America Now's model of Lean Six Sigma. We would save $500 billion a year by having an efficient, effective federal government. We would open up federal lands, increasing dramatically both jobs and the amount of revenue to the federal government. There are lots of things you can do if you decide to break out of the current mindless bureaucracy of the city.
So that's essential, Newt Gingrich, in two ways, I think. One is he challenges people by saying, if we were serious, and he repeated that like a mantra several times in the longer version of that answer last night, and, you know, acknowledging all the baggage that he has, this is still how he presents himself and what is attractive about him to many people. He seems to be really serious, and he says, if we were serious, and he seems to mean it. And then he uses these phrases, which makes him sound like an intellectual, which maybe he is, like Lean Six Sigma. What is it?
Lean Six Sigma is an idea that has its origins with Jack Welch, the celebrated former CEO of General Electric. And it's an idea for kind of continuous process innovation to continue to find new efficiencies in any particular business enterprise. But one thing about that, let's be serious, then let's do this thing that's going to be a magic bullet that will solve all of our problems, is kind of funny, because in a way, a serious thing to say is that, hey, these problems are actually really hard to solve. Yeah. Whereas he's saying, let me say this thing that sounds kind of familiar to you that you might not fully understand, but it's actually going to make everything super duper easy. And that I don't know if that's necessarily a very serious view.
And there was an interesting take on Gingrich on Slate by John Dickerson, their political correspondent. He said, Gingrich is a whirring dispensary of ideas and insults. He's going to eliminate White House czars on his first day in office. The super committee is the single dumbest legislative idea he's ever heard of. Government retraining will be available for lawyers who lose their jobs because of tort reform. The delay in building a border fence is utterly stupid. So there's the opposite of amnesty. But, you know, Dickerson is looking at this language to make him sound kind of dangerously black and white.
Well, one of the things about Newt Gingrich is that a little known fact about him is that during the 1960s, he went to Republican National Conventions as a Rockefeller activist. That is, he was someone who was a huge and enthusiastic backer while he was living in New Orleans of Nelson Rockefeller, who was known as the leader of the moderate faction of the Republican Party. And in a way, the interesting thing about Gingrich is that he advances a lot of ideas that are friendly to the kind of business class part of the Republican Party, to moderates who believe that government has a role. For example, has also backed huge increases in research in brain science. Yet he does it in a way that has this very sharp, feisty, testy flavor to it that perhaps endears him to people who are on the right of the party. So he's a figure who is not very well understood by a lot of people outside of the conservative movement, in my view. And I think that, you know, he really is a lot more moderate than a lot of people think in a way that might not endear him in the future to conservatives.
We will see what happens if he becomes the not Mitt with staying power. Raihan Salam from the Daily and National Review, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, Cooper Union considers a radical idea, tuition. Why is the last bastion of free college education on the verge of giving it up? Stay with us.